guys, we're live. Welcome to the Unknown Pod. We're grateful for you guys. My name is Jordan Bush. I am the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. I'll let Jim, you introduce yourself, and then everybody else can go around the horn.
Jim McAndrew from Magnolia Foundation. It's a nonprofit. We're helping churches understand and use Bitcoin.
Tim Fox, also from Magnolia, teaching churches how to use Bitcoin, getting them more comfortable with it. I'm a minister in the PCA.
Let's go. Teaching elder. Matt, go for it, dude. Oh, Matt's gone. All right. If Matt comes back, we'll let you know. All right, guys. So again, as we are wont to do, this podcast, here's what we do. We spend time on Twitter every week. And rather than just let our time perusing the intertweets, the intertwebs, letting it go by the wayside, we want to redeem it. And so we want to basically take things that we found and that we thought, you know what, I have an angle on this. I think it would be helpful to talk through. I don't know what I think about that. I feel like I would love to get Tim's perspective or Jim's perspective. We kind of, file those things away and then we bring them up and we chat through them. Some of them will be funny. Most of them are just more serious things on a number of fronts, whether it's theology, whether it's fatherhood, manhood, more broadly, Bitcoin, obviously, could be any one of a number of things. So that's kind of what we're doing here. I've got the iPod this week, if you will. So I'll be sharing the different tweets that we've compiled. So I'm going to go ahead and we're going to start out talking this week about gold, because I had the privilege a few weeks ago to be up in Moscow, Idaho, and take part in a debate on the cross-politic program between myself representing the Bitcoin side, another guy who's representing gold, basically a Christian case for gold, and another guy making a Christian case for basically stocks, mutual funds, quote-unquote TradFi, even though that's somewhat humorous given that those things have been around for way less time than gold has. So we basically did this debate. It went for about 2 hours. It was a lot of fun. But there was one point at the beginning of this debate where they talked about, they asked us, what is money? And the gold guy, we allowed him to give the answer. And this was part of what he answered. And in upon reflecting upon it, we were like, hey, there's some unquestioned assumptions there that we'd love to chat through. So what we're going to do is we are going to watch a little clip. You guys can find this, the full clip, and watch this thing you should be able to find it on Twitter or on YouTube. But we're going to watch this little abbreviated clip and you'll see the issue that we had. Here we go. Let's try this.
I want to go back to the original question again, but maybe give me some Bible verses behind what is money. I'm trying to think as we're talking, like what could I lay my foundation on to find money and tie it to scriptures?
There is gold in the land of Havila.
Hallelujah.
And the gold of that land is good.
Very good. There's two people on the face of the earth and we need a medium of exchange for them to transact transactions. Kind of important there.
So are you saying like, gold is intrinsically valuable because God said it was?
That's
my claim.
Tim, what are your thoughts when you hear that?
Interesting idea. Very bad exegesis. You have to ask, what does it mean when it says that it's good? The verse there, it says, it's talking about these rivers that come out of Eden. The second one comes from this land, Havila, where there's gold, Genesis 2:12, and the gold of that land is good. Bdellium and onyx stone are there. And then it goes on to the other rivers. And so, okay, well, what does it mean when it says it's good? It doesn't say anything about money. It doesn't say this is the only money that Adam and Eve can use as money. You have to ask, what sense is it good? A lot of things in Genesis 1 and 2 are described as good. Centipedes on the sixth day of creation being created by God are described as good. But you wouldn't say, well, therefore, centipedes are God's form of money and we should use centipedes or ospreys or oak trees or whatever. And, even things like in Genesis 3, something that in one sense is good another sense is not good. Eve sees that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is good for eating, and she takes and she eats it. In Hebrew, the word good can mean, things like useful. So I don't know. What does it mean that the gold there is good? Probably that it's easy to get to. It's easy to access.
there's a bunch, there's these other precious stones. He didn't mention these other precious stones that are there. It also seems interested in mentioning that, implying that they are also good or at least available. You know, if you really want to push it, you could say, well, God's form of money is only the gold that comes from Avila, because that's the gold that he mentioned. It gets a little silly, but kind of quickly. So I don't know. I appreciate the brother, but it's not what it's talking about at all.
So I have a question on it. Austrian economics says that there is no intrinsic value. All value is subjective and determined at the margins. So is God subjectively valuing the gold? And like, if God subjectively values something, do we have to, does that make it an objective valuation?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the Austrian economic thing about subjective value is true, but you have to qualify it because it freaks Christians out, because it sounds like you're saying moral relativism. It's all subjective. Well, most of the time, we don't want to say things are subjectively valuable. Jordan, explain what we do mean by this.
Yeah, again, this is one of these things where, we're not saying that this moral relativism, we're talking about among things under the sun, like especially things that don't bear the image of God, like there's subjective value to things. So if I'm on a desert island by myself, gold's not going to be a very good use to me. And it's not going to be anywhere near as useful as it would be if I was another place, useful, valuable, whatever word you want to put on it. There could be other situations where if I'm stuck for some reason in a pond and, you know, listen, water is incredibly necessary, but if I'm surrounded by water, if I have a ton of, maybe Lake Michigan's a better idea. I'm in the middle of Lake Michigan. Like, again, I have all the water in the world, but its value to relative to me in that moment is very low, because there's a whole bunch of other things. I'd rather have land than water at that point. And so like, this is where it's subjective in that sense. It's not saying in some sort of absolute, larger sense, and it's not required for us to talk at that level all the time. Like it's actually unhelpful to kind of focus on.
I think there's like theological categories and value. Like we as human beings, as image bearers of God, have value because God says we have value.
Yeah.
And then there's like economic value, right? So it's like, it's not clear to me that God is saying it's good in the economic value sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to ask, well, in what sense is it good? And if you're looking in the context of the first couple of books of the Bible, like, well, gold doesn't really seem to matter as money. It matters for its beauty. You put it in the tabernacle. It makes things glorious because God is glorious. It's associated with the most central places of worshiping God in the Holy of Holies and the Ark of the Covenant and those things. It is valuable, but not because it's a medium of exchange, but because it reminds you of heaven and it reminds you of God. And I think none of us would deny that. We'd all say, yeah, gold is really pretty. It has a lot of uses for beautiful things. It has worked well at different times in history for money, but maybe not anymore. But we still would say, yeah, it's still good and wonderful and glorious and reminds us of God in heaven. I wish Bitcoin was pretty and beautiful, but it's not. But that's not what it's for.
I mean, while we're on the topic of monetary metals, doesn't it say like in 2 Kings, when Solomon's taken over, that silver is as common as copper or something? It's become worthless, essentially.
It actually says that gold has been like stones during Solomon's reign. Like gold is even gold. But again, that wouldn't be to say that it's not valuable. It's just basically saying,
it's just a nod to the idea that like, you know, gold or silver or any other monetary metal really only has any economic value to the extent that it's scarce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
God said so.
Yes. This is where I would want to go. I would want to focus on in critiquing the thing that was said is to act like it's just gold itself. That is the, you know, like God said that gold has value and thus it has value, and not tie the value of it to the properties of gold is a mistake to me. Like that there, like the properties, like scarcity is one of them. There is beauty. There is some interesting things that the theologians like James Jordan have pointed out, where it's like gold is this, it's been seen by all kinds of theologians, philosophers, thinkers as like this kingly metal, because you can't turn gold into like a weapon. It's too soft to be used as a weapon. So there's a whole bunch of interesting things, but yeah, I think the other critique that I had upon reflecting on it is just the idea of like, okay, so the fact that this is said in Genesis, like means that this was what people immediately thought. Again, which is what the other guy, the point that he makes of like, yep, there's two people on the earth. They need gold to transact. It's like, no, they didn't. That's not what was going on. And it's really important to remember that the author of the Pentateuch was Moses. So Moses is saying this as like a, it's like a parenthetical reference to his audience and just basically saying, hey, the gold that was there was really good, right? Like it's not necessarily, it's not clear to me. It's not obvious that this is somehow he's saying this for the benefit of people from all times. And you know, like that's what kind of what he's doing. He's just basically saying like, this is the type of a note that you do see in few other places in scripture that, again, it's not necessarily designed to indicate that Adam and Eve were using gold. I don't think that that's true. I don't think that they, you know, they were. Just logically, it doesn't make sense that you would need it for.
Well, and you would expect too that if this was uniquely chosen by God as money, that you would see in the Old Testament law where he was much more directive about what people could do. He would say you can only bring money when you bring your offerings or whatever. He doesn't say that. I mean, most of the time shekels have to do with silver. You know, most people in the agrarian ancient world could not have to carry around gold in the quantities they needed to use. They used less valuable monies because it worked. It made sense in terms of a shekel being, you know, that big instead of the same thing for gold being, you know, a couple little pieces of sand or something.
Correctly.
Yeah. Help me out with the original Hebrew here. Like in Genesis 1, when it's God saw that it was good. Is this the same sense?
Maybe. I mean, I'm agnostic. It doesn't say you have to go from the context of what kind of good. I think probably in this case, it means useful good, easy to get to good. But maybe not the same kind of good as when God creates his creation and says it's good. Some people go weird directions with that. And they say, oh, no. What that means is that God's creation is going to do what he wants. And it's also full of all kinds of death and suffering. And that's okay because good doesn't mean good. Good just means useful. And so you got to be careful. In that sense, no, God's creation is not merely useful. But other things can be good. I mean, right before that, it talks about God making all the other trees. I was just looking at this. And it says that they are good for they're good for eating and they're desirable to eat. And so it's like, okay, right there a few verses before, you have the sense in which good means useful. But even within Genesis 1 and 2, I don't think it always means merely useful. It's also beautiful. There is another sense in which God's creation is good and free of sin and suffering. Those kinds of things, but those are all slightly different, even in the same chapter.
Do you have a take, Matt?
I don't think this goes against anything you said, but the durability of all precious metals, silver, gold, and the rest is also points to the fact that you can hold it for a long time. You can bury it. You can make it into beautiful things, as was said earlier. So that goes along with scarce. There's a lot of things that are scarce that are durable. And again, this is in line with what you're saying. So it's durable. It's beautiful. The throne room of God is, you know, looks like there's precious metals and jewels and things like that. The future kingdom of God, so forth. So I guess I would just throw in the utility of it. And we now know that it conducts electricity very well. So there's other purposes for it that is not simply man's choice.
Yep.
I think one other thing, too, is just, I mean, the way, and again, the way that I've always read that passage where it talks about the gold being good, I'm like, it seems to me more of like a qualitative goodness where it's like, is this gold more pure or something? Like it has less alloys than some other gold.
Like the ore, you know, has less impurities or something?
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of how I was always read it. It doesn't have to necessarily be that, but so
right. It's just specific about that gold. You know, gold is gold, yeah. Gold, but it's saying, well, that gold, yeah. This.
Yeah, like that. Like it's kind of a weird thing to say if that's not what's, it seems like it's contrasting it with other types of gold.
The fact that it's qualified to a specific location, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at. So I just don't, it just doesn't make sense. The kind of things that were being said and the way that it was being extrapolated from, you know, from that. Now, obviously we all would accept that, you know, like the characteristics of gold or do make it good money. But it again, the usage of money in terms of the medium of exchange usage of money is secondary to like it being a store of value. This is something that the Austrians have, right? Is again, because if nobody values something, they're not going to use it. And so obviously the fact that there's a number of different reasons people value it, that leads towards, you know, towards, it's not the only thing, but it leads toward it being demanded. There being demand and, you know, desirability of it. And so then it leads it to being used, and it serves better than almost than everything else between gold and silver. You know, it serves better than other things for the purpose the purposes that people have and the needs that they have. So,
all right.
I think, again, it's really important just to keep hammering down on like, why is this important? And then once you get those questions, you start to see why gold was valued, gold and silver and things like that.
So you want to move on to why Dave Ramsey now subjectively values Bitcoin?
All right, here we go. We are ready for this. So this is a great segue, Jim. Very, very, very well done. So we have big news as of yesterday afternoon, late in the afternoon, Corey Bates, let's share this here. Corey Bates shared this news. We'll probably play this clip too here. Actually, it's going to make me do this again. Hold on. We have news that Dave Ramsey is apparently softening his stance on Bitcoin. Dave, famous Bitcoin bear. It is just not Rat Poison Squared. That was Warren Buffett, but he did not have very good things to say either. And this has been going back to, do you remember the first time he referenced it? Was it 2015?
I don't remember.
I think I think it was like 2015. Here we are. All right.
Stable investment. Today's question comes from Felix in North Dakota. Bitcoin has been going through the roof recently, and it looks like it's becoming more and more of a stable investment. Do you now recommend it as an investment, or do you still believe it's too dangerous of an investment and that people should steer clear of it?
Oh,
good question.
I'm actually interested to see what you say about
to clear the air on Bitcoin, because people really want to know my opinion, said no one. Yeah. Here's the deal. I've never been anti-Bitcoin. We took a call yesterday, Ken. Young man had every single one of his dollars in Bitcoin. Had nothing in savings, everything in Bitcoin. And he'd been doing really well. And he asked us, well, what's wrong with this? And I'm going, you've been alive for 4 days. So yeah, if you just think this is how it's always going to be, then sure. But, you know, we've seen things. We've seen Bitcoin drop 50% in value in 2022. It's 24/7. There's a lot of fraud and scams around the crypto world right now. It's been on a wild trend up lately. And so you're going, well, why invest in the stock market to get a measly 10% when I could get 1,000%? Mm-hmm. So what it really comes down to is what I call the three stooges of wealth, which trips people up, especially young people. It's fear, greed, and pride. So it's the, I'm so scared. There's the FOMO of I got to get in this now or else I'm going to be broke forever. Mm-hmm. There's the pride of, well, I know better. There's a little bit of arrogance there. Mm-hmm. And then there's the greed of just like, I'm not going to settle for 12% and a slow way to wealth when I can make it a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
And so with Bitcoin, it's like investing in any single stock that's been on a wild ride. You know, you see NVIDIA going up and then DeepSeek from China came out. NVIDIA takes it. And there's all this just gyration and fear in the market of what anything's going to do. And it's why I recommend diversifying. So it really comes down to diversifying versus Bitcoin equals bad. And it's more that you got all your eggs in one basket. That's too much risk for one person to handle. And so if you want to invest in Bitcoin, I can't say invest. If you want to speculate in Bitcoin, put some money in that after you've already invested 15% of your income into retirement, to tax advantage retirement plans, proven mutual funds and index funds, be my guest and use your fund money to do that, knowing this is money you could burn on the table. But putting all the chips in on Bitcoin, I'm telling you, I think history is going to show that was a very risky move. Mm. Now, there's Bitcoin billionaires out there who are going, ha ha, and they're laughing from their private islands right now.
Mm-hmm.
That could be the case.
Well, I think it's here. I think there's no question that cryptocurrency is here to stay. So
as a technology, the blockchain, it's here. Gosh.
Yeah. And I would say Bitcoin is here. I'm not saying Bitcoin can't fall. I'm not saying I disagree with anything you said. In fact, I agree with everything. I would say to somebody, yeah, you want to invest in Bitcoin? I would treat it just like we tell people to go sit down with a SmartVestor Pro and learn about the strategies so that you understand what you're doing. But I agree with you that it should be a part of a diversified strategy, not all eggs in that basket. I agree with that.
Today's question comes.
Shoot, there we go. All right. So again, lot more color there than just simply he's on board now. And obviously on top of that, this is not Dave Ramsey. For those of you who aren't familiar with his work, Dave is not present, but the fact that he allowed his platform to be used for this, to kind of make this pretty seismic change is fascinating to say the least. So Jim, thoughts?
Were they kind of gaslighting there a little bit and saying that it should be part of a diversified? They were kind of making it sound like they always agreed that it should have been part of a diversified portfolio.
Yeah, that it was really interesting because they definitely have come down really hard on it in the past. And now they're kind of like, wait, what are you talking about?
Yeah, what are you talking about? We've always said it should be part of a diversified portfolio. I don't know. It seems a little, really.
I think we should just take the win. You know, it's like, this is great. This is a big deal. You know, Dave Ramsey is a really, really big influence on the evangelical world and finances. And, you know, there's been a lot of good things. I took his class when I was just about to get married and it really helped me. No one ever taught me this stuff. My parents didn't teach me. It was super helpful. But you know, there's some things I don't like about him and it's not just because he's poo-pooed Bitcoin for a long time. But yeah, this is great. I think even the fact that the door is opening a little bit of like, well, yeah, maybe some, that's a big deal. And, you know, you hate to admit it in some ways, but the main reason that people start paying attention to Bitcoin, even if they maybe have a little bit, is because of the number go up technology. And
yep,
it's like, yeah, if people are around long enough, they think about it and their friends have told them about it. But yeah, who knows why they've softened on it, but I think we should celebrate the win, even with all of the weirdness and the things you'd want to qualify.
I mean, I'm celebrating the win. They ended it with, you shouldn't be greedy, but feel free to speculate. Isn't that greed when you're speculating? I mean, come on. We all know that Bitcoin's not investing, it's saving. So
the other thing of just like acting like the only speculation that exists is within Bitcoin. You know, here, you can give us lots of money. It's for us to put into our, you know, all of our guys' places. That's totally reasonable. Totally very, very wise. Very thought
out. Well, and the irony too of him criticizing people for being into Bitcoin because of what's recently happened. And they think that it's always going to be that way. Like, dude, look in the mirror. I mean, the whole stock market mutual fund thing. I mean, people just assume, oh, look, it's been going up forever. It's going to keep going up forever. And it's like, you know, even, you know, the 60-40 portfolio of stocks and bonds, like that's been really bad for years.
Yeah.
And like, you know, his whole thing is just, oh, isn't that great? You know, you just sit on the stock market and these mutual funds and you get 12% a year and it just goes on and on forever. And it's like, first of all, that's not really true. But it's also like, there's no guarantee that that's going to keep going and there's no mathematical way it can keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, everything he both, I mean, really, honestly, both in favor and against Bitcoin, everything that he said was all superficial, like above ground reasonings for this. It was basically pragmatism of just like, here, this is actually beneficial or it's not, or it's data, whatever. It's got nothing to do with, hey, here's the fundamental issues of like what money is, the history behind this, you know, like they're like money's currencies fail over time. And so you want to have like, he's very much, it's just so, so pragmatic and not rooted in anything lasting. And so again, we can still take the win. We can still be happy that, you know, plenty of people will take this as gospel and start buying. But, yeah, I still, again, to Tim's point, I always am careful to say this when I talk to normal people, for whatever the criticisms that I have and whatever, you know, well-founded criticisms, Dave Ramsey has saved, I mean, probably thousands of marriages. He like just from people being saved from themselves. So like, again, we don't want to just throw the Davey out with the bathwater, because again, the Lord has used him in a lot of good ways. But at the same time, neither do we, you know, do we have to, you know, baptize every opinion that he has as gospel. So,
Tim, do you have time for one more?
Yeah, let's do one more.
I will show this one. Hold on. Let's see here. This is my response to the Dave Ramsey thing real quick here.
Oh, okay.
I just retweeted what Corey shared and then did this. Okay, so the bear border collie is dead, okay? So I just Google, or I put in ChatGPT, if Dave Ramsey was an animal, what would he be? They tried to make him a bull. I was like, no, that sounds too positive. So then they said, alternatively, you could call for a border collie. So I then promptly threw into ChatGPT, there's a guy, Color or Cran Smell, I think is the artist who did this original painting. That the original one shows it's a bear. It's back from when the bear whale was killed in the early days of Bitcoin. So I just replaced it with a border collie and there he was. So anyhow, that's all we have on that front. Where does the last one, Jim? Tee it up before it.
So if Bitcoin is saving, not speculation, what is the new speculation? Is it Bitcoin treasury companies? And is all the leverage that they're introducing into the system going to be the downfall of this cycle? There was a tweet on that one.
Yeah,
if you want to pull it up.
Pulling it up now. Here we go. Boom. Jim, you want to read that one?
Yeah. Stack Hodler. Bitcoin treasury companies are this cycle's ship coins. Think about it. These companies are creating shares out of thin air to sell to people hoping to outperform Bitcoin. That's their product. It's just TradFi ship coinery. And many will get wrecked. It goes on for a while after that. But to be clear, we're talking about the OG MicroStrategy and then, you know, Jack Mahler's new company, Metaplanet, and then even derivatives on top of those like YieldMax, you know, Misty. What do you guys think? Are these the new altcoins?
Actually, here, why don't you just kind of give your perspective first, and then we'll let Tim go next, because I know he's gonna bounce.
I think it's possible that they could cause a lot of problems and cause a lot of pain down the line. But I think it's categorically different than altcoins, because unlike altcoins, and it says it later on in the post, these are accretive to Bitcoin, right? As you put more dollars into these things, it pumps the price of Bitcoin, as opposed to when you put dollars into altcoins, it suppresses the price of Bitcoin, right? Because mostly people are selling Bitcoin to buy the altcoins. So I think what's more of an interesting question is a levered up company more or less likely to panic sell than a retail investor, say in the 2017 days, when altcoins were all the rage? There's part of me that feels like the companies are going to be stronger hodlers, but the other part of me, you know, because they're less emotional, right? But then the other part of me says, well, they've got all this leverage. And so I don't know exactly what their balance sheets look like and what their cash flows look like. A lot of these companies don't even have any cash flow anymore. I mean, MicroStrategy has some cash flow, but it's becoming like an increasingly small percentage relative to the size of its Bitcoin stack. And so, yeah.
So there's going to be potential sell pressure is basically what you're saying.
Because of the leverage, right? You know, Michael Saylor can be as laser-eyed as anybody. And he is, he's more laser-eyed than anybody, and he's never going to sell anything. But he also is operating in a publicly traded company that has to answer to a board and do quarterly reports and things. And so it'll just be interesting to see if they have enough reserves to ride it out. You know, part of me feels like the sailors of the world just maybe are assuming that the cycle is dead and it's just going to be up and to the right forever, Laura. So it would be interesting. It would be nice to hear from Michael, on his thoughts of what's going to happen if Bitcoin draws down 80%. Can Mr. handle that? Are they going to
straight now?
Yeah. Are they going to be able to hodl through that? I mean, I know like back in the 2017 days, like full confessions here, I was buying some altcoins and I was definitely tempted as a retail investor that didn't have my head screwed on straight to panic sell those altcoins. And then also by default panic sell the Bitcoin to shore up the altcoin positions. So that's my personal experience, it might take. So I don't
know. Hey, paper hand McAndrew over here. Tim, go for it.
I was thinking the other day, I think in a lot of ways, altcoinery is a state of mind. And you can, in a way, be a degenerate altcoiner with Bitcoin itself in terms of just, you know, fixating, obsessing on making more money, borrowing a lot of money to do crazy things. And so I don't know. It's like, I have a very primitive understanding of corporate finance. I really don't quite understand how all these things work, and they are foreign to me. I mean, I think it touches on a lot on this big question that we've been wrestling with for thousands of years about the epics of making money off of money. And for, you know, most Christians for most of history have said, there's something inherently wrong with making money off of money. And the church has softened on that across its various branches. The Protestant Reformation, especially at the time, you know, they were kind of warming up to that idea as banking was developing and finance was developing. But I think it's understandable. It feels like, how are these people making money? And I look at some of these things, these derivatives of derivatives, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It feels like this is all too good to be true. And I don't know. I fear for regular normal people who, in this altcoining state of mind in the Bitcoin universe of layers of finance, are like, well, I like Bitcoin, but I'm going to run after these things that are give me twice the yield or three times the yield or whatever. And they really don't quite understand what they're doing. And they may be getting taken for a ride by people who do, like hedge funds or algorithms.
I feel like that's one category of people, but then there's another category of people that would at least say the narrative that they want to pump capital into like MicroStrategy in order to pump the price of Bitcoin and get the Bitcoin adoption to happen faster, because MicroStrategy has access to debt markets that retail investors don't. You know, it can just issue bonds at like 0% coupons and things. And so the bang for your buck, like if you just put money into Strategy, it can turn that into three times the amount of Bitcoin that you could directly. And so it's just going to make the adoption happen faster.
This is the Judas theory of capital allocation. This is like the theory that like Jesus, the Judas betrayed Jesus to gave Jesus over to the Roman, to the Pharisees and to the Romans in the hope that it would like set off, you know, him coming to the throne or whatever. Are you familiar with this, Tim?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I talked to a Mormon bishop on a flight recently, and he said the same thing about Eve. He said, no, we think Eve was doing something good by rebelling against God because she knew that it's what it would take for us to mature.
So you guys reject this narrative about buying Strategy pumps Bitcoin? You reject that narrative?
I mean, it may.
Yeah.
I think, it very well could. I just think, I don't know. It's like the great thing about Bitcoin is that you're not depending on a board. You don't have a CEO who may or may not do things. It's like, okay, the more you kind of step back into more and more people being involved and more and more people making these decisions and allocations, there's just more potential for things to go really badly. And I don't know. I'm worried for people who don't totally understand it all and don't understand who's sitting on the other side of the table trading against them.
Yeah. Again, I don't think that it's not that these things can't pump the price of Bitcoin. It's that there's risk. You're taking on different risk that, you know, you might not be aware of, or even if you're comfortable, even if you do know, like I'm sure Saylor knows the risk, but like, and so you're comfortable with it, you know, it all the cards, it's wide open for you. You know, but that's still the risk that doesn't seem very likely to happen happens all the time. And like we see these things happen all the time, especially with Bitcoin. People get wrecked by getting over their skis on leverage all the time in the Bitcoin space.
Not even just the leverage, though, just the institutional risk of the only way to hold shares in these things is to do it in a TradFi way in Fidelity or whatever. And so it's like, are they going to freeze your account and not let you? Are they going to stop trading? You know, like Bitcoin, theoretically, if Bitcoin melts faces and moons, and MicroStrategy is, you know, a 2x or a 3x Bitcoin, then it's like, oh, we're going to halt trading because it goes from 400 to 4,000 in like 2 days or something, you know?
Yes. Oh, and this is a Radu. He's a guy on Twitter. So as soon as MicroStrategy announced that they were going to be buying Bitcoin, he went out and bought options on MSTR. And his total MSTR returns as of right now are around 21,000%. So like he's absolutely killing it. But he actually tweeted like a week ago that he went in to buy more. I can't remember which one of these products. And they had locked his account. Like wherever it was, Fidelity or one of these things, like they wouldn't let him buy anymore. And so again, it's exactly what you're describing is, you know, you can have this great plan on paper and then just not be able to execute it. This is what happened with the GameStop people. Again, like they had this great plan until the constraints of the system prevented them from doing it, because, you know, they would have succeeded and it would have had, you know, negative effects on the powers that be within that system. So, I mean, you could talk about the custody in this respect as well. Like the fact that Coinbase holds so much of Saylor's Bitcoin and so much of this other Bitcoin, I don't like that either. That doesn't make me feel good.
So there's another part of this narrative where it's like, you got to leave.
See you, Tim. Appreciate you, bro.
All right. The other part of this narrative is like, I need to hold Misty, for example, to have income in order to not have to sell my seed corn.
Mm.
What do you think about that narrative?
If you think about being in Bitcoin as being part of a revolution, then I think MSTR, MSTY is kind of part of the team, you know? I'm with the rebels against the empire kind of feeling. And I don't own any, but I've been very interested in the story. Something you said, Jim, it just shows my ignorance. I you know, something you said about it a second ago, how they have access because of their being in with the Egyptians, which is I'm about to say something about that, to do things that individuals and small businesses can't do. So I'm not sure what a Star Wars analogy would be, but using the Egyptian analogy, is it sort of using debt like this sort of robbing the Egyptians perspective? Or is it being an Egyptian, being, you know, Babylon system? Mm. And I think that there's a way of looking at it that it is sort of robbing the Egyptians. You know, the Protestants that started the USA made it so that when you take risk, your ultimate worst case scenario, unless you do something illegal, is you lose all your money and you get to try again. That's a lot different than going into bond slavery until you pay it back. You know, so I don't know if that hits anything, but going back to the revolution aspect, it seems to me that Sailor is a part of the revolution. The stuff that GameStop was doing is also kind of a way of being in the system, but bucking against the system. And so I wouldn't have any issues with investing in that, except I have nothing more to put in.
So you're saying they're in the system, but not of the system? Is that what you're saying there, Matt?
Yeah. I mean, so what I was talking about was Sailor gave a presentation last week or something at Strategy World or whatever their conference is called. He was talking about how there's, I can't remember, it's like 4 million companies in the world and 400,000 of them are junk, you know, small companies or whatever. And then 4,000 are publicly traded. And then of those publicly traded ones, 400 are in the United States. And then of those, you know, there's like another, it's like 40 of them or something that can just, without... basically same day, go and issue like a bond, and they don't have to go through some long approval process with the SEC. And Strategy is one of those companies. And so he just has access to things that we don't have. I think what's an interesting question is this debt? What is this? Is it debt or is it equity? So think about it in the sense of if you go sell a bond, theoretically, the people that are buying the bond, if it's not the Federal Reserve, are putting in real dollars. Granted, those dollars are probably fractional reserve dollars, and so they are debt-based. But like those people had to have an equity account somewhere that had those dollars in them, right? And so if they buy the bond, it's real equity in a sense, as opposed to, say, the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. If there comes a time in the future when the Federal Reserve literally starts printing money to buy Bitcoin, is there a different ethic there? Like, is it kind of okay what Michael Saylor's doing? Because he's just taking like existing dollars that were kind of like, yeah, they were created sort of in iniquity, but he's almost redeeming them by making them flow into an equity-based system.
Yeah.
Whereas like the federal government doing it would be creating new ones. And so it's like, we don't want to cause any new dollars to be created, you know? But at the same time, it's almost like we do want that to happen because then it'll just pump Bitcoin and then in the dollar sooner. So it's like, is it okay to have dollars created in iniquity in that case?
This is where two things can be true at the same time. Here, give me one second. Two things can be true at the same time of like something can be illicit for Sailor and still be beneficial to the rest of us. Right. Like it can be like this happens all the time. Like, you know, it'd be hard to think of an example, but like something can be true. Like, again, somebody can make an action that for them is actually not good. Like they shouldn't do it, but other people can reap the benefit of them doing it.
It
really gets
a little like this, even the story of Joseph, right? Like his brothers did it for evil.
Yes. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. Like that dynamic exists. And then even within that, it can even get more complicated because then you have one of some of my favorite passages in the scripture are the ones where you have basically sanctified deception practiced by, you know, practiced
like
by
the midwives.
The midwives. You've got JL and Sisera. That's another good one. You have, this is an interesting framing because a lot of people just give, they just really judge Abraham for it. But just like Abraham lying to Pharaoh and to, is it Absalom? I can't remember who it is. Abimelech. About Sarah. Like there's a whole bunch of them. There's just a bunch of them where it actually is more complicated. Like they're, you know, what they're doing, they are deceiving, they are lying, like they're lying to their face. But then you get to this whole thing of, all right, in war, like we have more tolerance for these things. And it seems like even God has more tolerance for these things, or God has certain expectations that we will exercise certain types of deception. And there's a way, because there's a way in which certain types of deception, like in the case of the Hebrew midwives, that actually demonstrated their faith. And because they weren't doing it to just save their own lives. They were doing it to save the lives of others. And so in that sense, like the bigger picture thing is to keep the great commandment, love God and love your neighbor. And so like that you can do that while lying to unjust leaders or unjust, you know.
Bottom line, as Christians, are we allowed to buy MicroStrategy?
I don't understand. In my mind, is this not even a question of are you allowed to? Like, especially if you're buying the underlying, you know, MSTR. Like, that's, you're buying stock in a company. Like, I have a pittance, a small amount, did not buy early, bought, you know, a few months ago. My kids have a few shares. Like, it's, you know, I don't feel bad at all about that. It's more of like, is this just, why would I do this when I can buy Bitcoin? Like, that's kind of my broader perspective on it.
Well, okay. So, but the idea of MSTI, so buying MSTI to get income so you don't have to sell your Bitcoin. What about that?
Yeah, that's, I don't know. It's still that's more, again, it's not necessarily, I wouldn't be arguing on the level of like, this is illicit or something. It just seems when you start to get too cute, like that's how I feel about MSTI. And what's the other one?
There's an opposite of it. It's like I something that's like for the short side.
Sure. Whatever. Those things are just, I feel like they just get too cute. It's like, all right, you know, we're playing fiat games and we're trying to, you know, get fiat prizes.
No, we're playing fiat games and getting Bitcoin prizes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So then it's just like, shall we do, you know? Yeah. I don't know. I don't have like a super clear, I don't know.
Well, it's like the system we live in, you know? And so it's
sure.
Just like, yeah, I don't think we're recommending that anybody buy these things if they don't already own real Bitcoin off the exchange, not on Coinbase.
Yeah. Well, here's another example of this. Jim, do you own or would you buy Palantir?
No.
Okay. Now, for a lot of people, I actually had a conversation with a guy. I think, I can't remember if we talked about it in the podcast a few weeks ago. I had a conversation with a guy. He was like super skeptical of Bitcoin, which I understand. You know, that's totally normal. But he just basically kind of like was patting me on the head in terms of just like, hey man, like I'm not trying to say this, but like honestly, I've gotten way better performance from some of my other stocks than I would have had if I would have put that money in Bitcoin. And I was like, oh yeah, sure, like that's totally possible over a short time period. I was like, what was the company? Do you mind me asking? And he goes, oh, it was Palantir. And I was like, oh, see, like, I was like, you couldn't pay me to own Palantir, actually. Like, I would never want to do that. Like, I could give you five moral arguments against owning Palantir because of the downstream effects of it. But again, what you're getting into is the ethics of investment, the ethics of money production, we've kind of already talked about. Like, there are ethical concerns here. There's ethical constraints that ought to govern your actions, especially if you're a Christian. Now, again, you want those. It's not just about your conscience, because your conscience can be overly sensitive. And so we want our consciences to be trained. But I just think the average person thinks nowhere near enough about the ethical logic of the decisions that they're making. So
was that guy a Christian?
He was a Christian. Yeah. Yeah. Again, he's in that. See, this is what happens is fiat. It basically, because everyone is just trying to make enough money to retire or trying to make enough money to do this, you become pragmatists. You become just like money at any cost. Like, oh, this, plug my ears. If you're going to tell me something that could potentially lead me to not be able to make as much money as I think I need or as much as I would want, la, 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 I don't want to know that. And so you're looking at truth as a threat to your, like as a threat to your well-being and you know, your life, rather than something that is designed to free you and free other people and protect you and protect other people.
Well, full disclosure, I do own some Mister.
Yeah.
When I told my wife about it, she was just like, why do we have to play these fiat games? Like, why do we have to like be just scrambling for return? You know, it's like, we shouldn't be, there's something about it that even when it's not, you know, overtly,
you know,
Palantir, it's not Palantir.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You still feel like somehow dirty or something.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, here's another thing of just like, I mean, there's other situations, right? Like if you have a company, if you work for a company that they're doing like a matching 401k, okay, there's a perfect reason to not, you can't use that money to buy Bitcoin, right? Then boom, load up, like load up on your MSTR, load up on whatever these other, you know, some of these other things like that, in that case, there's a perfect example. Like this is, you know, like if there are good options, like boom, go out and do them. Like you be a good steward of that. And, you know, that's a way where, you know, you're going to multiply resources that can be deployed later down the road to help you, to help other people, you know, whatever. I think there's an easy case for that. So, yeah, I don't feel bad. I own MicroStrategy. I don't feel bad about it. I just look at it like, I kind of think about it like this could disappear at any time. Like, that's just how I think about it. It's because, yeah, I mean, the government could step in. Like, the government has done this in the past, you know.
Can you pull up the one on the ownership changing from River?
Which was that one? Oh, yeah, here we go. Did I get that one?
It's on the spreadsheet.
In the solution is being willing to lose it.
Wait, treasury company. There we go. Boom. Dude, were you going to say something, Matt?
I think, you know, part of being in the revolution, Star Wars style, is that you are willing to be Rogue One also and just get blown up on the planet, you know? So I do think that if there was a meaningful, I looked, especially in the early part, at Bitcoin also in the Oregon case, it could go a different way. Something could happen. I'm not a highly proficient technical person. But I want to be part of this revolution.
Poor Matt. So, absolutely didn't wrecked by the internet, deities.
Oh, let me try one more day. Serves him right for living in Hawaii.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, here we go. There we go.
Okay.
River shares this tweet. Go for it, Jim.
Yeah, River shares a tweet. Businesses are the largest net buyer of Bitcoin so far this year, led by Strategy, which makes up 77% of the growth. And there's a chart. So it shows businesses have picked up an additional 157,000 Bitcoin, funds and ETFs, 49,000 Bitcoin. And then, you know, government and other are kind of in the middle. And then individuals have given up 247,000 Bitcoin. This is the change in ownership in 2025.
Yeah.
So the, I guess, devil's advocate for, or I guess to steel man the opposite side of the case here for the Bitcoin maxis on why you shouldn't buy Mister, is that this is accelerating the shift from Bitcoin's decentralized nature being in the hands of individuals and coins sort of becoming accumulated up the chain into companies like Strategy that are unfortunately holding a lot of their coins at places like Coinbase.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, maybe in the short term you get more gains or something, but in the long term it makes the network more fragile or better, you know, brittle or whatever.
Do you want to add anything on that, Matt?
Yeah, let's give this a try on my tech side. You know, I will add the old get kidnapped and tortured for your Bitcoin angle, which is if I was ultra wealthy, I'd probably be throwing a lot of mine on Coinbase or somewhere so that was less likely to happen.
I mean, yeah, obviously like multi-sig can help with that, but it just requires such a level of technical understanding that, you know, probably for most people just leaving on River or something makes sense.
I think another thing to remember here with these numbers is we did have some of the coins from Mt. Gox that people got in their settlements. I can't remember when that was, but it wasn't too long ago. And so a lot of that, you had people who either bought or had this Bitcoin for whatever it is, 13, 14 years, something, but who didn't have access to sell. So like weren't able to, you know, weren't able to make, to take profits in any of these gains. And so, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these, you know, a lot of this transfer was coming from people who are in that situation. And so that's more understandable. The other thing is, I mean, there, we have to remember that there are individuals who own insane amounts of Bitcoin. And so like there are people who from these early days where you're getting, you know, you could do one of those faucets and get 5 Bitcoin, you know, for free. Anybody who wanted to could do it. There's guys mining thousands of Bitcoin. So like, it's still, I mean, a lot of these guys, they've held through 3-4 cycles and I mean, are, you know, can turn this into $500 million, billions of dollars. Like this is all just a realistic thing. And so a lot of these guys, it's not just like they're, this isn't just like normal plebs buying, holding for 2 years, 3 years, and then selling Bitcoin back into the hands of Michael Saylor. Like that's just, I don't think that's.
So are you realizing that
what's going on?
Most of the shift from individuals to institutions is from OGs?
Yeah, that would be my take on it is I still think normal plebs are accumulating, like normal people are accumulating, but just the scale of things like Gox coins, OG holders selling, all this kind of stuff. Because like another thing that happens is there's been times where the supply on exchanges gets lower. And then what these exchanges do is they go out. And so talk about making, what is the reason people do Misty? They need...
The income?
Income. So basically you have points where it gets low. And then a lot of these OGs, the exchanges go to the OGs and basically say, hey, we'll pay you a premium. We'll pay you 5-10%, whatever it is, above the spot price just to have your coins on our exchange. And so like, yeah, I don't know. Like there's some of that that's going on too. Like they're looking at this, like I'm making revenue stream off of these old coins that I have.
So could you make the argument that shifting from OGs into institutions is actually making it more decentralized in a way? Because like the owners of Strategy, there's lots of owners of Strategy, right? The people that own the stock. And so if a bunch of coins shift from an OG to Strategy, yeah, they're all stored in one place at Coinbase or something, but it's decentralized in terms of kind of who has paper claims on them.
Yeah, I think that's entirely likely. And I think that, again, this is why I don't think this is a problem. I'm not worried about this.
Well, I guess the question is, do you feel like it's inexorable that Bitcoin will become accumulated into a few institution vaults and like self-sovereignty, you know, hodling by individuals is going to like, that's not the future of Bitcoin. Like the future of Bitcoin is people just have it in their bank account.
No, I think we are still so ridiculously early in terms of people just like understanding it. I mean, the other thing,
do you really think people are going to run their own node and have their own hardware wallets? There's no way. Like when we get to like 90% adoption in the world, it's just going to be like in people's bank accounts.
Yeah. I definitely think no, the average person is not going to do that. Now here's the case for that happening. Okay. Here's the case for that happening. And I've heard people talk about this and the people have posited this, like you're going to have a node in your internet. What's it called? The box.
You talking about the router?
The router. Like you could put like there. Could you foresee a future in which every router has a node inside of it?
Well, sure. But like, if you're not choosing what software to install in there, then who knows what kind of node it is?
Sure. Sure. Again, but these are, again, the issue is like some of this is, yes. Are we going to get to 90%? No, but that's never, I mean, you could name 100 things like that. Like you can think about it in like a Christian context, how many Christians actually understand the scriptures well enough to teach it? What percentage, you know, probably not very high. Like if you were to actually...
I guess what I'm saying though is my point is like the Bitcoin maxi, laser eye Bitcoin maxis are like, no, it's got to be sovereign individuals and self-custody and, you know, to the max. And it's like, let's be honest. The reality is that is not the future. And so the better question is, how do we not end up in a world of rehypothecation? Like, is there any good way, you know? And obviously Rivers doing good by publishing proof of reserves, and maybe that's what people should demand, and you shouldn't bank at a bank that holds Bitcoin that doesn't show proof of reserves. But even then, it's like, how many people even check the proof of reserves or technically capable of checking it, you know? So it's more just like, Is there anything we can do, whether or not it's at the protocol level or the social level or having more podcasts or whatever, to make sure that when we end up in the world of, you know, custodial Bitcoin, it's not some hellscape?
Yeah. But again, I think this is still, I think the spiritual analogy, like the Christian discipleship analogy, is a good one here. It's like, all right, how many, what percentage of Christians can actually, you know, like interpret the scriptures well, preach a sermon? Like, it's always going to be a very small relative to the total number of Christians. It's always going to be a small number. But the thing is, you get this intransigent minority. Like, you don't have to, like, you don't need everyone and their mom to be running a node to basically to have like a very big impact. Again, I'm not saying that what you're saying is not a danger. I'm not even saying that it's not likely. But I still think there's the incentives are there for people to learn and for people to either going to find out the hard way. I think that's really what we've seen over and over again, is people find out the hard way as individuals get blown up, as companies get blown up. Basically, people, more and more people find out why doing these things matter. They find out why taking ownership of things matters. And I think if we're returning to a world governed by hard money and governed by more direct relationship between sowing and reaping, of like, you feel the consequences of, if I lose my Bitcoin, they're gone. Like, there's no getting it back. Like, I'm more optimistic that as that becomes, you know, more ingrained, people will take more responsibility for, you know, to try to understand what they're operating with. Two days ago, I made this exact, I basically said this, I argued in a similar way that this is actually one of the things that concerns me, and why people would actually cry out for a more centralized system and actually object to Bitcoin, because it's too much responsibility for a lot of people. They don't want the responsibility. It's like Israel and it's like God says, hey, you guys don't need a king. I'm going to save you from the cost of having a king, where you have to give 10% of your stuff. You have to give your, you know, a king is going to take your kids. He's going to take all these things. God says, I'm going to save you from that. I'm going to be your king. I'm going to rule. It's going to be great. And within a few generations, the people go, no, actually, we just want a king. We want to be like all the other nations. And so I definitely think there's a danger of the average person, many people just going, hey, what you mean that like this bad guy can, you know, grab my hand as I'm sending a transaction. He can send my Bitcoin to his wallet. It's gone forever. There's nothing I can do about it. I don't want to be in that kind of system. I can totally see
a Bitcoin bank with basically FDIC insurance.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
What do you think, Matt? You think Bitcoin's inevitably go into this world of custodial Bitcoin?
I think I agree with you, Jim, that it's going to head that direction. Let's just say for the vast majority of people. And if you take me for an example, you know, I've got 6 kids. I'm trying to figure out what to do with my assets this year. And I'm going back to the Misty MSTR thing. One of the reasons I haven't invested or done anything in that is I go, wow, that's interesting. I ain't got time to check in on it and make sure I'm still happy I have it. You know? I don't have time to follow the news report and stuff like that. So I'm just keeping it in Bitcoin. So that's like a real practical thing of like, I'm looking at the Misty thing as like years ago, I was in BlockFi when they were giving 9% or something like that, you know, and I did not lose it. I got out in time. But that part of that is I was watching what was going on in the world, you know, so I was able to make a few thousand bucks that way.
Yeah.
And then I got out in time. So I look at especially MSTY from a very non-specified, very non-technical perspective. And I'm looking at it like, this is probably a great temporary thing. Sorry, my kids are making noise. But I don't have time to check in on and make sure. Also, anecdote, last week, somebody that I know that comes over to my house all the time lost $20,000 due to people getting their keys and stealing their Bitcoin. So it really does happen, and he probably wishes today he was on Coinbase or something. You know, now it was his fault. He broke the cardinal rule of making sure that your keys are not on the interwebs anywhere. You know, he made that mistake, but nevertheless, that's the majority of people.
Cut him out again.
Bummer.
Bummer. This is actually unfortunate timing on, you know, mentioning Coinbase because they just had like some scandal this morning of somebody losing money. Although apparently it was a somebody who worked for them gave customer information to somebody who like bribed them. So it wasn't even like a hack properly.
Yeah.
Are you guys able to hear me? Or
all right, we got a couple more things here. Oh, now we can.
Now it's coming.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and going to your point, Jordan, about pastors and
yeah. The Hawaiian internet affected by the fires or something. It's just doesn't want to work.
Are you wondering about space travel or robots?
Well, let's see here. Let's do this one because this is an interesting one. This is actually arguing our point from earlier. We're talking about, speaking of gold, we've got this right here. Let me share this over. Boom. We have some news on the gold front from the Hearn Collider. Here we go. Scientists at Hearn's Large Hadron Collider have successfully transformed lead into gold atoms, achieving an ancient alchemist's dream through modern physics. Okay, so this is just another reason, sell your gold because the scientists using voodoo can just make it. Jim, what are your thoughts?
So all you have to do is fund a scientific research project that lasts for 3 decades and you spent $200 billion on it and you get a tenth of an ounce of gold. It's great.
Yeah, here we go. Here's the grok check here. The claim that Kern's Large Hadron Collider turned lead into gold is true but overstated. Scientists at Kern's ALICE experiment briefly created gold nuclei by colliding lead nuclei. Removing protons. Yeah. 29 picograms existing for a fraction of a second. So they didn't even remain? Or what?
Yeah, they probably were like some sort of isotope that is not stable. And so,
oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. So anyhow, so not near as cool as it initially sounded. So, maybe you can still hold on to your gold. Time will tell.
Yeah. But I think what's interesting is, as a civilization, we are going to use more and more energy and there's a lot of energy to use. And so this is one of the big claims against Bitcoin is how much energy it uses. Right. And so I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of as a species for using more energy. In fact, I think God put it there and I think he put it there for a reason, which tees up the next one pretty well. If you want to pull up the type one civilization one.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I was good. And I had I had the robot one all ready to roll.
No, we want to end on that one. That's a real downer.
There we go. All right, Jesse Pelton, who couldn't be more wrong, but let's take a look at what he has to say. not script, sons of guns. Here we go. All right. Here we go. Boom. Jim, take it away.
Okay. So regarding energy usage, if God wanted us to build a type one civilization, so let's back up. What is that? So there was this guy, Kardashev. He came up with this theory of different levels or types of civilizations. A type one civilization is a civilization that effectively figures out how to use all the energy of the planet that it starts on. Type two is one that figures out how to use all the energy of the star that the planet orbits. And then type three is it figures out how to use like all the energy of all the stars in its galaxy. Just checking in, we're not even type one. We're actually like type 0.5 or something because we don't even use all the energy that's on the Earth. Okay.
Yeah.
So anyways, he's talking about, just getting to that level. So one.
But if we were to try to get to that level.
Yeah. So one, he would have put a giant fusion reactor in the sky. So the sun, it emits a certain type of radiation that we're able to absorb with. Two, 28% of the Earth's crust made out of a semiconductor with a matching band gap. So this is essentially silicon, which is what we use in both solar panels and computers. And then three, if you scroll down a little bit.
Yeah, hold on. So is this? There we go. Okay, sorry. Yeah, there's your band gap.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's still frozen.
Oh, no. Is it? Okay. Hold on.
Maybe you need to like reshare it or something.
Try that. How's that?
Yeah. Three. Okay. Fill the oceans with an alkali metal we could use to store limitless quantities of energy. So essentially this is how batteries are made.
Yeah.
So there's all this energy, and then we have elements that are able to capture that energy, and then elements that are able to store that energy. And of course, then this would lead to becoming a type one civilization, which is the first step to becoming a multiplanetary and a interstellar and possibly even intergalactic species, which is what Elon's trying to push. We'll get to Elon more in a second here at the end of the podcast, but for now, Elon's trying to make us multiplanetary because I guess in Elon's economy, consciousness is sort of the end all be all of everything. And so it would be a shame if consciousness were snuffed out because of something silly like an asteroid hitting us and we're the only ones that we know of. So why would God create a setup like this if he didn't expect us to go explore the stars? Jordan, go.
Yeah. So again, I'm not going to talk about whether or not God at some point might want us to explore the stars. what again, this comes back to order of operations. Okay. This comes down to, cause I have a take I made here on this podcast, not in the past, of the idea that space travel is satanic. It's a satanic psyop designed to get you to focus on cool things in the future rather than the things that you actually are responsible for, and the things that God has actually given to you right now. I just think this is one of these things where if you look at the way that we're able to do this, I mean, so much of space exploration and stuff is fueled by fiat currency. It's fueled by, you know, just like taking value from the future, dragging it back into the present. Because just the sheer amount of money that you need, it's very difficult to maintain on a sound money standard because you just...
Are you talking about like NASA and the budget they were spending during the rune, like Apollo program?
Yeah. Okay, but like... I know you're a noted rune skeptic. I don't know. I know you're very skeptical if we went there, Jim, but...
No, we definitely landed on the moon for sure. but, you know, Elon's doing SpaceX and it's not... I mean, obviously they do have government contracts.
Correct.
It is a private company. And if he wasn't focused sort of on the future and what that could be, then it wouldn't happen. And so at what point, like how far in the future does it have to be satanic?
Yeah. Well, so the satanic thing stems from like, honestly, if you think about like, how could these resources being used? Like, first of all, we know that so much of the United States budget and other budgets from other governments are just funding pedophiles out of the world. Like, so like, that's one thing. Like we could be definitely using that money better. So maybe it's like, if we were handling all that money better, then maybe we could focus on, you know, doing things like space travel.
So is it like some percentage of our wealth that should be spent? Like if it's above 50%, then we've crossed the line into Satanism.
Well, so here's the deal. It's like, what's in the case of Elon? What? So this would be the better question does it have to be fear of the future that's motivating it? Because that is what's motivating Elon. He's motivated by, I'm terrified about the future. So I'm terrified. And again, he can justify it by saying I'm terrified for humanity's sake. So he wants us to get out of here. Now as a Christian, we don't have that type of fear. Like we don't have fear on that level.
I'm glad you brought this up. Can you pull up the next one real quick on the robots?
Oh yeah. All right. Let's see here. All right. Can you see that or no? Nope.
Not yet.
Share. Boom. Share this one. Boom. There you go.
Okay. So what we have,
is there music to this or no?
I think there is. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe not. There was another one that came out yesterday that had, it's a little bit longer or whatever, but essentially we've got, Elon's account, which is Nate, he's renamed himself
Gorklon.
Gorklon Rust or something. I don't really get the joke, but, you have a robot that's tap dancing. So this is the Optimus robot. If you roll the clock back 6 months, or I can't remember how long ago it was when he announced the robo taxis or whatever. He had these robots and they were kind of walking around, but they were all just not great. And you could tell it was like, there's a long way to go. And now we've got essentially, you know, a tap dancing robot that looks as good as any human. And
yeah.
I'm assuming this is real. I mean, the robot's like chained to a thing in case it falls over. But so my take on this is we're all going to die.
I love how Jim just doxed himself. Side note, Jim just doxed himself as an awful dancer if this amounts to peak tits.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, obviously we're not going to die because the robots are going to dance us to death. It's just that the fact that they've come this far, this fast is kind of disturbing and shocking all at once.
Yeah.
Layered on, so going back to your previous conversation, saying Elon's doing it motivated out of fear, this is actually the reason he started OpenAI, was because he's very fearful of AI.
Hmm.
But now he's started essentially Grok. XAI is worth more than X now. He's got the Optimus robot from Tesla. I mean, to view X and Tesla and SpaceX or all these things as different, it's not all different. They're all just Elon, right?
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, you've got Elon terrified and trying to get us off this planet because he thinks we're all going to die. And then on the other hand, you have Elon pushing this future where we're all going to die. So it's like, which one is it? Is he afraid we're all going to die, or is he causing us to all die?
Yeah. Yeah, man. It's a good question. Can both be true? I mean, the other thing is like,
I mean, I would rather it be Elon than Sam Altman. Okay.
Well, again, what you just laid out is that the stopgap to all these things, both good and bad, is just Elon, right? Like, I mean, if Elon died, what would happen to all these things? Like, I mean, he's getting him to the point where they just would, like, this would concern me if I was Elon. Right? He's like, it's one thing where the prospect of doing all these cool things exists, that, and you're the smartest person in the room by six orders of magnitude. It's one thing where, again, the powers that be are like, all right, Elon, we need you around to build these things. But then they get to a certain level where you're like, all right, this is advanced enough. We kill you and get you out of the way. Or we just, you know, government co-opt for national security reason. Like that's, I mean, again, I'm not terrified of this even still, but I just think like.
You're not terrified of this dancing robot?
I mean, obviously I see where this can go.
I mean, if I can indulge in Grok and all the AI that's going into training the self-driving cars and stuff and sticking it into a robot like this, and then all of a sudden you've got a 600-pound piece of metal that's going to come and punch you in the face and you can't turn it off.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I definitely don't like this. The bigger thing for me is just like, where's that? We talked about this on one of the last episodes of, there's this report. It was Paul Tudor Jones was talking about being at this report, being at this meeting with all the heads of the five.
It's going to take 100 million people to die. And I was like, it's going to be way more than that.
Yeah. And so, all this whole thing, the bigger problem of just like, dude, no one's thinking about what are the consequences of this. They're all thinking about themselves as atomized individuals and companies. And like, there's so much money to be made. We can't turn this down. And this is where just the concept of fiduciary responsibility, like it is such a fraught concept because you're like, how do we denominate fiduciary responsibility? Like you're acting like money is the only the only factor here. Short term, it's not even just money. It's short term gain is the only thing that matters.
Do you think there's a difference between Elon doing SpaceX and wanting to become multiplanetary out of fear and creating the humanity ending AI out of fear?
Well, what would be the why, like creating the humanity ending AI out of fear? What's his fear?
What he said is that he's pushing Grok because OpenAI is clearly going in the exact opposite direction of what he wanted it to do, which was to create basically an open source AI that could potentially be made safe or at least be made available to everybody all at once. So it's not like one government and one military has the AI and the other ones don't. And so I think in his view, Grok or XAI, whatever you want to call it, is the spiritual successor to what OpenAI should have been.
Yeah.
And he's going to put all of his resources behind it to get there first because it's sort of a winner takes all thing. Once the first superintelligence comes about, the other ones can't happen at that point, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, man. There's just a lot of stuff. It's just deep. And I don't feel like I have, these are too high for me.
We can come back to it.
Well, what do you think? I mean, you're making the case. You basically believe Elon. That's what you're saying. You're like, hey, I think Elon doing this is a necessary evil.
I think that on the AI front, at this point, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
From a technology standpoint, not necessarily from a theological standpoint.
Sure.
So if it's going to be anybody, I guess I would rather it be Elon, but I don't, that's like 0.1% better, because we're talking about, in my mind, it's like, I'm not alone on this. Just yesterday, so I've been following MIRI, which is the Machine Institute for Research or for Intelligence. There's this AI safety researcher named Eliezer Yudakovsky, and he's coming out with a new book, which is essentially like, you know, I can't remember the exact title. It's like the first person that builds it ends us all or something.
Is that the one you sent us the other day?
Yeah, I sent it yesterday. He's very, very pessimistic. And other guys like Max Tegmark, who are a little more middle of the road, Max has been pushing for basically like AI accords at the government level for years to like, you know, get people to, hey, let's just halt for 6 months. Like all AI labs, let's halt. But they never get any traction because it's like the nuclear stuff.
Yes.
You sign all these things that say you're not going to, you know, nuclear proliferation or whatever. And it's like, you're still just making them underground. And
you don't trust. Yeah. You can't trust that the, you know, the Chinese aren't actually doing it or that we're not actually doing it. Like all these things.
Yeah. Yeah. So the AI one, I'm definitely more disturbed on, but at the same time, if anyone builds it, everyone dies. I mean, they're being a little bit hyperbolic there, but it's because nobody is listening and nobody cares. People just blithely use Grok or ChatGPT or whatever, and they're not even considering. They put it in the same category as any other technology, like social media or whatever. And it's I think it's something categorically different. Okay, so that's on the AI side. I'm not enthused about it, but I'm okay with it because it just doesn't line up with my eschatology. It seems like there's going to be Christians that are alive when Jesus comes back, and I don't think he's come back yet. I know the preterists would argue with me on that one, or at least the hyper preterists. On the space exploration side, I am super on board and bullish about that. I'm like, I do not buy that argument at all of like, oh, well, we've got hungry people here to feed and you're just blowing resources on going to space. Like, to me, that's sort of just this backwards woke, like liberal kind of argument that's like, you know what? Like, if you want to spend your money on feeding poor people or whatever, go for it. But like, I think I'm totally morally justified in spending money on trying to get to another planet.
And again, this is, if you want to privately fund these things, like that's one thing. But again, so much of this came, so much of NASA was government research, right? Like
your objection is just the government funding.
Well, my objection is, again, this is like, where does the government get money from? And like, well, right now, the reality is exactly. That's my point. That's where that's the thing is like, if we're getting rid of fiat currency, then what is the path towards the amount of money needed to do this thing if you're on a Bitcoin standard?
Why single out space travel? What about all the other things the government spends money on?
Well, I would be happy to. Like, let's look, I'm, yes, war, like lots of wars.
That's what I'm saying. Like, we spend way more money on entitlement programs and war than we spend on space.
Correct. Oh, yeah. So, but yeah, I don't,
even in the height,
all those
I think even in the height of the Apollo program, it was like, I think it was still like just 5%, which is a lot, like percentage wise of the GDP, but it was still just 5%. Sure. Whereas like the military industrial complex has been double digit percentages, well over like 20% for decades.
Yeah. Yes. And yeah, this is not to say that I agree with any of those things or I'm cool with all. I think I want to end them all. But again, I do think that's a question. So, I mean, what is your, if the world keeps going towards Bitcoin, it seems like a binary choice of like, either we have Bitcoin and scarce money or we don't. And so by virtue of that, we get all these things that would require a lot more upfront capital. No, or
I don't think that SpaceX, I think under the current system, it, at least at the beginning, it may have needed government funding to survive, like government contracts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've already passed the point where there's like an escape velocity there, where they have income generating businesses like Starlink that it can start to pay for itself without, because that's totally private. Like Starlink has nothing to do with the government. The government is a customer of it, but they're not, they're just like everybody else. I mean, I don't know, maybe Elon gives the military special faster access or something in war zones or over in Ukraine or something. But I think given the fact that this is our system currently, I'm okay with Elon having taken, if you want to call it subsidies, to make it happen. I wish the system wasn't like that, but it was. But we are.
And you're saying if the cost of it not being Elon, like there's other people who are trying to do it. So you're kind of resigned to it.
What's interesting is that all the other companies that were doing it in the system of, we want to perpetuate the current funding model, which is it all comes from the government and it's all cost plus. And so you end up with basically like United Launch Alliance, which is essentially like Lockheed and Boeing. And you have like the SLS system, which is tens of billions of dollars. And they've done like one or two launches, and they're like test launches. They're not even actually doing any real. They literally just took all the old parts of the space shuttle and the Apollo program and just like stuck them together into a Frankenstein kind of spaceship. Whereas like, and they're totally fine with that because they're just making money cost plus, right? And so they're raking in profit. That's all they cared about. Yep. Whereas Elon, and if you look at like their systems, they're not reusable. They weren't trying to get the cost down. Whereas Elon's whole point from the beginning has been, we're going to make it like a tenth or less of the cost. So that way it doesn't require nation states to fund this thing. It can be funded by private entities.
Mm.
And he's basically done that. Like even with just Falcon 9, like Starship is going to be 100 times more efficient than Falcon 9. And I think it's going to unlock an amazing amount of human flourishing and productivity that we can't even imagine, just because our framework is so, it's like this fixed pie mindset where it's like, oh, well, we're on the earth and all we have is the resources here and the space here. And so we all just need to kind of get along and not use too much and stop burning fossil fuels and whatever. And it's just like, guys, the universe is huge. Like it's so mind-bogglingly huge. And I have a hard time believing that God put it there as a flex. Like, really?
Yeah.
That's it? It's just a flex? Like, we're not supposed to do this?
So, to be clear, that's not necessarily what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, again, it's a matter of order of operations. What do you do when? And so, like, that's kind of how I look at this is, like what are we supposed to...
What do you think needs to happen before this?
What I'm saying is, I'm just saying, like, this is how, if we're looking at this from like a Christian standpoint, okay, like, boom, like here you have all of this, all the resources we have. Okay. Boom. We Christians, we're out here discipling the world. We disciple the world. We disciple the whole thing. And then like, if do I have a problem conceiving of for all of eternity, part of what we're doing is like, we're cruising around the universe. Like that would be incredible. I think that would be incredible. I'm just saying like again, to try the mindset of the motivation, the justification for we need to escape this planet. So we're going to devote gazillions of publicly funded dollars towards doing this. Like it doesn't bode well for me. The other thing is like, I look at the situation and the level of stuff that we're doing. And I'm like, this is like Tower of Babel junk, dude. Like this is, I mean, just staggering. When you think about
going between the AI and the space travel,
one of the incredible things that it says in Genesis 11, I think is what it is, Genesis 11, is it's like God looks down, he sees what they're doing. He goes, there's nothing that they won't be able to do. And that's not a compliment. So like, and now again, maybe we're far enough in the game, far enough along in the game, where, like we are in the end game, and all of the premillennial guys are like, yeah, that's what we've been saying. You know, maybe we are like we're far enough in the end game where, you know, this is how it's gonna play out. But yeah, I just wonder,
so, you know, like what you're taking objection to, like Elon's motivation, like his motivation of just trying to save ourselves versus flying on the
motivation. Board. Yeah, like the broader human motivation of like, this is a poor eschatology. This is a poor, it's like, it's a wrong like eschatology. Like we don't have to be afraid of these kind of things happening and then justify as a justification to start spending gazillions of dollars that we literally just create out of thin air, that steal money from everyone on earth, that perpetually puts people into poverty, that, you know, it's just like the cost in the immediate term of doing it is enormous.
Elon is trying to reduce the costs, unlike any other companies in this space. So you got to give him credit for that.
Sure. And no matter, again,
it's an interesting question. I pose it like,
whatever.
If we invent science and technology to predict tsunamis and earthquakes and volcano eruptions and things like that,
sure.
Should we sit around and expect God to save us from those? Or should we be like, no, we're going to take measures to avoid getting killed in a tsunami?
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
Is there any difference between that and getting hit by an asteroid?
Go for it.
I might have a better connection now. I'm interested in what you brought up, the preterist versus, let's say, on the extreme end, a dispensational view could be lots of in-betweens. But it's kind of interesting to me. I was thinking the same thing. For a preterist, the idea, or the vibe, let's say, not to nail it all down, the vibe is that we're moving forward, discipling the nations, and at the appropriate time, the Lord will come back, but he's preparing the world for his return through our actions, more or less. Whereas the more fearful side of don't polish the brass on the Titanic while it's sinking, a dispensationalist is like optimist. It's in the image of a person. This is what it's talking about. You're going to bow down to the image that has a voice and stuff like that. And so I think most likely all of us would agree that we are, in a sense, we're supposed to be marrying and giving in marriage and starting businesses and taking care of our families and not concerning ourselves with, is the Lord coming back today? Because he didn't say it'll be like that. And you, my people, need to be ready for me. He said, go on about your business, which includes discipling the nations. Very interesting spin. Do you guys have any response to that in terms of how the Christian eschatological kind of spectrum?
So on the AI side of things, where I kind of fall back and I'm like, it doesn't seem like Jesus is going to come back to a world where all the Christians are dead. It's an interesting point on the space travel side of things. Does it seem like Jesus is going to come back to a galaxy that we've inhabited 100,000 planets? Or is he coming back to Earth? Or is he coming back to 100,000 different planets? And does he have to like, does he come back on all of them? Or he comes back on Earth and then the other people... Like it does seem like Jesus is going to come back to Earth. And so, you know, if it's 100,000 years in the future and there's 100,000 planets that we've colonized, it's like, well, he's coming back on the clouds here, but they don't even find out for 10,000 years.
I agree. I agree with your concern. And so that could lead to at least here's one outcome is that all Christians go, wow, is this the end times? Is he coming back soon? Another one is, and this is a tricky one, you know, there's a temple motif that relates to the earth, I think. The temple motif being, here's the presence of God. We know that God's everywhere, but he's especially in the tabernacle. He's especially in the temple. And the temple motif for the planet Earth is like, there's no other place he created mankind. There's only just one place. And you go to zoom in on the earth and then, okay, on the earth, it's all covered in water. Okay, he makes the land come out and then now he puts people there. Now, even on the land, it's all wilderness and he creates one place, a garden, and there he walks with people. And so I have to admit that I've always considered the earth, and I still do, unless my mind has changed. The earth is that place. And it seems to me, you know, the cube, Borg-shaped city of God, the New Jerusalem, comes down on where? Onto the earth, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's where the people are coming in and out. So I've always thought space travel, and I mean, you have unlimited time, unlimited resources, etc. I've always thought of that as potentially a part of eternity. But I'm with you. I'm not saying I'm refuse to believe it. I just don't see it in the picture. I see this kind of temple motif, like God is especially placed his presence in certain places. But to be fair, I just thought it was right now. The new temple is the Holy Spirit within us. So,
but I do think I take it literally that Jesus is going to come back in the same way that he left. Okay.
Yeah.
Physical body, which by definition is in one place at one time.
Yep.
In the clouds. And so you could make the same argument, like if you go back to like Christopher Columbus times, like, oh, we're going to sail off and explore the new world. And it's like, well, if Jesus comes back, it's probably going to be like around Jerusalem And so if we're over farting around in the Americas,
we're not gonna miss it.
We're not gonna be able to see it, you know? So like, is there really any difference between going across an ocean or going across four different star systems?
Like, unless you might be teleporting. So then it's not even a problem to go back. You
know? Well, let's not even talk about teleportation, in my opinion, is death. I think we're going to have to cut this one off, though. I'll find a good post on that. We should get into that because this is a very fascinating philosophical discussion of, you know, cloning and teleportation and uploading your brain into computers and what does it subjectively feel like?
Yeah. A lot of good questions. I think it's helpful to think through these things. It's fascinating, right? How quickly eschatology just comes up. You're talking about things which I think is actually helpful in a lot of ways.
Are you willing to go on record and say what your stance is?
I feel like I'm somewhere between either like post-mill or a-mill.
A-mill. Yeah, yeah, kind of an optimistic a-mill myself.
Yeah.
I think I'm still in the optimistic historic pre-mill, but I think it was John Frame said the one he holds to is the last one he studied.
Yeah, that's, I haven't studied it like hardcore in years. And so it's on my to-do list and I just haven't made it back around yet. But
I think Tim likes to say pan mill, it's all going to pan out.
I think the important thing theologically is you have to understand what is the challenging part of the position you are holding to. Because if you just think it all explains it and comes out your way, wrong. Yep. That's not true. It's very difficult to parse, you know?
Yep.
And
but it is interesting that your eschatology could affect like your decision to wanting to explore the stars or not, you know?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, no, definitely. And this will not be the last time we have this discussion, because I really do think it'd be fun to do like a war game exercise where you just like follow these things to the logical conclusion. Like the government gets to do this. They do this all the time. It'd be fun to do like a Christian war gaming of a lot of this stuff. Maybe we should talk about who we want to get in on that, because that'd be fun.
Something that is something for you, or it sounds like we're wrapping up, but something that'd be fun to talk about in light of this too, and it's something my imagination is trying to work with lately, is AI is going to be, it is a national security issue, and it requires massive amounts of power. So I see the future for all nations being huge amounts of power generation being happening, and that is good for mankind. So I mental exercise, what does it look like when we generate 100 times as much power as we do right now, you know? And I'm talking about every single aspect of life would be different than it is now. And I think,
well, if you think more power consumption is good, then you inexorably end up at, we have to get off this planet because most of the power is out there.
But even with nuclear, like you feel like most of the power, isn't that like effectively unlimited power?
Well, at our current level of civilization, I'm just saying most of the energy that's being generated in the universe is coming from stars. And so like, even if we harnessed all of the power of our one sun, there's still billions of suns in our galaxy that we're not harvesting.
Sure. So, yeah. Oh man, too much.
Did we already cover the the Dhruv article? I can't remember. It was talking about blockchains, like galactic scale blockchains.
No, we didn't talk about it on the podcast. You told us about it, I think.
Okay,
I think you told us about maybe offline or something.
So it's the law of hash horizons.
Yeah,
and so.
Bring that. Basically, we'll do that next time. That would be because, again, it deserves
I'll wet
more.
People's noodles on it.
Do it.
Bitcoin. So for the Bitcoin maxis that are just like, it's Bitcoin forever, you know, whatever, for 1,000 years. Bitcoin has this physical limitation to where when you get to a certain orbit where it takes, you know, if you're kind of outside like five light minutes, essentially, of the orbit of Earth, you can no longer mine Bitcoin viably. So we can get into that one, but it sort of is the idea that there's going to have to be other chains that get spun up that may just be duplicates of Bitcoin, but the consensus parameters are changed and it can't be 10-minute blocks anymore.
So this would be if we reached intergalactic.
Even intergalactic, just like Mars. Like if there's people on Mars and there's people on Earth and they want to transact, they cannot do it on layer zero Bitcoin. Like there's going to have to be two blockchains and then like a bigger blockchain above them that's operating at a slower time frame.
My gosh, dude. That's insane. Anyhow, yes. We'll come back. Well, we'll do that one maybe next week. We'll do that one. Okay. That'd be a fun thing to talk about. Jim, Matt, so sorry for your internet issues. Hopefully we can get those sourced and figured out. We are grateful for you guys for joining us on this episode. Again, I want to just remind everybody that if you're going to be in Vegas, we are going to be doing a TGFB Friends and Family Barbecue. We'd love to have you there. We still got a few dozen tickets left. But again, they very well might not be there for very long because I know I talked to, actually, one of the things we haven't even talked about this yet, but Steve Turley, if you're familiar with who he is, YouTuber, he's got like 1.25 million YouTube subscribers. He's going to be coming to our barbecue. And so he's going to be, he's basically, we like made some tickets available to his audience. And so it's very, very likely that a good number of the ones that are still remaining are going to be sold by him. But yeah, if you're a fan of his, come on, we'd love to see you. And even if not, we'd love to have you come hang out with us and eat some delicious barbecue. I have also just confirmed with my buddy who's doing all the cooking, we are going to have ribs. Okay. We're going to have brisket, ribs, pulled pork. Let's see.
Ribs or beef ribs?
That's a good question. I need to confirm. I will let you know. But it's beef is back on the menu or even more on the menu. So we'd love to have you there. And so anyhow, join us. We'd love to have you. And we'll see you on the next episode of To the Unknown Pod.
See you guys.